the first sentence of the introduction. It is a natural assumption made in philosophy before we start to deal with this proper subject matter, namely the actual cognition of what truly is, we must first of all come to an understanding about cognition, which is regarded either as the instrument to get hold of the absolute or as the medium through which one discovers it. The sentence is false. It's not a natural assumption. No one actually thought about it at all until Descartes. No, I mean, it's literally false. It's false, right? So you have to read the rhetoric of the sentence. You have to read this book. It's full of false sentences in other people's voices. And you've got to figure out for any particular sentence whether it's the voice of the time or the voice of the philosopher or the voice of a particular form of consciousness. You've got to know what you're reading. And you can do that by asking yourselves obvious sorts of questions. It is a natural assumption. Natural to whom? Natural where? Right? And of course the answer is it's not natural. It's going to, in fact, the natural assumption is the assumption of epistemology as first philosophy. And the idea of epistemology as first philosophy, that is, before we get onto the business of knowing, that's called the business of science proper, we do a prolegomena and we step back and examine our powers of knowing. So the thought that knowledge is either an instrument or a medium. The idea of it being a medium is, I guess, the kind of standard spectacles reading of Kant's categories. They're a medium through which we interpret the world, or an instrument, Descartes' rules of method, or Locke's turning back and doing an inventory of the powers of knowing, or Hume's distinguishing between impressions and ideas. All of these are stepping back from the business of knowing and asking how we can know. And in doing that, we've already set ourselves into a difficulty. And in, by the way, just two pages, Hegel's going to dismiss this entire project, the project of modern philosophy, as a mistake. Now, of course, he can't really get rid of all of modern philosophy in two pages, but he's not going to commit himself to it either. But he's going to try to step aside of modern philosophy and its procedures. And we'll see how he steps aside. So he begins with the idea that knowledge is instrument or power. This is the Baconian idea that knowledge is for the sake of allowing us to become masters of nature, to control nature. And that the right way of thinking about knowledge is that it is as a tool for accomplishing a certain task. Now, once you begin thinking like that, once you have an instrumental view of knowledge, and the same holds for, by the way, instrumental theories of language. Right? Gadamer just does the same exact critique. Gadamer, by the way, is like a little pocket Hegelian, right? runs the whole thing over at the level of language. Once you begin that idea that knowledge is an instrument for doing something, then you've already made the idea of knowledge problematic, because if it's an instrument for doing something, then you've already separated the subject from the object. So the very idea, as we'll see in another paragraph, of thinking about knowledge as an instrument or medium presupposes subject-object dualism, and further presupposes that knowledge is not the way we inhabit the world, but a particular tool we use for negotiating the world that is completely independent of us. So already built into the first sentence is he's trying to ring a lot of bells, makes us anxious about the idea of epistemology as first philosophy. So after a couple of sentences of saying why this is a natural idea, he begins to try to unpick it. He tries to suggest that there are a series of fundamental paradoxes involved in the idea of treating knowledge as instrument or medium. The first is, of course, if it's an instrument, then it must alter the object. But in altering the object, in fashioning it, say by creating a categorical synthesis, it leaves the object itself behind. So the first paradox is the idea of an instrument generates the very opposite of what it intends. Secondly, if we choose it as a, he says, more or less passive medium through which the light of truth reaches us, then again we do not receive the truth as it is in itself, but only as it exists through and in this medium. So the very idea of treating knowledge as an instrument necessarily generates a gap between the knower and what the knower hopes to know. This is not the claim, and I want to be very careful with this. Hegel is the last person in the world to claim that we don't use categories, that we are not involved in categorical syntheses, that we don't use language, that our relationship to the world is not mediated by language. That's not the issue here. The issue is the language of instrumentality and knowledge being a medium and a power, problem one, and two, that it's something we can know before we know, which is the real dilemma. The real dilemma is, if I cannot know the world, why should it be the case that if I step back and look at the instrument, I can know it? What makes my relationship to the instrument of knowledge in any better shape any more plausible than I would have been my knowledge of the world. How is this idea of reflectively stepping back supposed to get me out of the dilemmas of realism? On the contrary, Hegel's suggestion is that the activity of stepping back just generates a second-order realism, namely a realism about the instruments of knowledge, which is why, of course, epistemology has only been a series of futile debates, because then you want to know, how do you really know that's the true method? How does Kant know those are the only categories we use? How do you know something is either an impression or an idea and cannot be anything in between, etc., etc., etc.? In other words, all the problems simply recur. Hence, any of the other ways of trying to imagine how this is going to work out, that is, treating it like a pair of glasses, and then trying to work out the laws of refraction, and subtracting them from what happens, you know, just get into the same, what he calls, superfluous effort. He therefore suggests, in ways that Heidegger finds distressing, that I shall say is merely methodological, that if the absolute is supposed merely to be brought nearer to us through this instrument without anything in it being altered, like a bird caught by a lime twig, pretty obscure. Harris, and whenever I'm stuck, I just say what Harris says. Harris thinks that that's a reference to Leibniz's idea that perceptions are simply preparatory intellections. It would surely laugh at our little roost to scorn if it were not with us in and for itself all along and of its own volition. What he means by that, and this becomes clearer in the next two paragraphs, is that it is methodologically necessary to assume, to presuppose that the actual is rational. That is a methodological postulate. And it's a methodological postulate because any other assumption is necessarily skeptical and therefore generates all the, what I've called, structural dilemmas of epistemology. That is, how do you get a firm foundation? How do you begin? How do you avoid realism? So Hegel wants to think about the idea that we must assume that the absolute, whatever it is, truth, whatever it is, is available. And that we actually already have something, a good deal of it. Because any other assumption just makes actually beginning impossible. Now, it's not to say that that methodological postulate cannot be defeated. And we'll talk about the conditions for defeat. But it is a claim that it is a methodologically necessary postulate. Well, why? Well, paragraph 74. If the fear of falling into error sets up a mistrust of science, which in the absence of such scruples gets on with the work itself and actually cognizes something, it is hard to see why we should not turn around and mistrust this very mistrust. Should we not be concerned as to whether this fear of error is not just the error itself? Well, if you look at those second two sentences of the introduction, those I did read, you'll see that what they both suggest is a fear of error. That the problem of knowledge arises because you have a fear or an anxiety that you may be erroneous, and it's that fear itself that generates the moment of reflective stepping back that we think of as epistemology. And the moment of stepping back that we think of as epistemology then is the cause of subject-object dualism. And once you've got subject-object dualism, that is, once you've reflectively placed the object outside your ken, you ain't going to get it back. So does this structure look familiar to anyone? Say anyone who's read Remembrance of Things Past, for example? It's a structure of jealousy. It's how do I know she's being faithful? I don't trust her. That's it. It's over. From that moment on, nothing she can do will be trustworthy because you already decided that you don't know if she is trustworthy, right? She may be, right? So you can lock her in a room and you can imprison her, and even her fantasies are going to be disloyal. Nothing will work. So epistemology is a form of maddened jealousy of a certain kind, or the anxiety of the jealous lover. And I say that, by the way, not by accident. We'll see that the structure of jealousy is actually part of the motor of this text.
It's also
Cavell's
interpretation of Stanley Cavell's interpretation of skepticism and of autonomy.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. It's how he wants to think about the relationship between Desdemona and that's probably what I had in mind about my thoughts there. But certainly, that's the thought here. The fear of error is the error. You have to see that that's a deep thought and not a shallow thought. Because you have to see how that fear or anxiety can then generate a series of responses. And that once those responses get going, they deepen the separation until there's no way back. Right? And that's part of the story that Hegel means to be telling. And he thinks that, as will come out in a second, that part of the reason why modern philosophers could do this and not notice the kind of trap they were in is because they had the view, wholly unjustified, that the mind was better known than the world, that you could have non-inferential self-knowledge of your own mental states, and that therefore part of the new individualism that you could be in possession of a kind of certainty about yourself, even if you knew nothing about the world. Now, if you think hard, just for, say, 17 or 18 seconds, imagine someone who is absolutely certain about their own inner states, but uncertain about the world. Think about what you're imagining. This is what we usually think of as a psychotic state. But, well, I mean that seriously. And I want you to think about what it means to think that we have a whole structure of philosophy that's premised on that idea that the inner is safe and knowable, but everything outside is mad, right? And of course, you know, the one person who knew that something was wrong with the structure was Hume in that famous passage where he says, I am a monster to myself, I think myself mad, and then has to go play billiards. But that's haunting. But it's a haunting and terrible moment because he cannot find why there should be this connection between what he takes to be austere and rational skepticism and his monstrosity, this sense of madness. He cannot diagnose why he has to literally put his best certainty about himself out of mind in order to enter the world. You have to leave behind your self-certainty in order to play billiards. But that's actually right. The point is, the billiards moment is the right moment. And the other moment is the problem. So, he goes on to suggest, just what I've just been trying to tell you that he's talking about, that this language of instrument and medium generates subject-object dualism and generates a whole series of further forms of deception in which we say we have knowledge, but not real knowledge. That's we know appearances and not things in themselves. Or we have knowledge, but there's something else that's true. That's, we have to limit knowledge in order to make room for faith. So we know appearances, but we have relationship to the absolute, the noumenal, by means of faith, which was both Kant and then Jacobi, in a way, made that the center of this whole philosophy. So you can have truth and have nevertheless something else true. So Hegel's suggesting, and again, we ought to be thinking about this now as anxious. And I know that every one of you finds talk about the absolute unnerving. That, you know, people shouldn't talk that way, right? But I'm trying to suggest that talking in the other way is crazy, right? That what looks like modesty actually is literally a form of madness because it presupposes a kind of dualism, but the dualism requires that you have, grab that before, internal certainty and external skepticism. That's all he has to say about epistemology. That's it for all of modern philosophy. He's done with it. So he has to kind of change the topic somehow. He has to kind of maneuver around it because he realizes, of course, that we still have these questions about knowledge and they haven't quite gone away. But whatever knowledge is, it ain't going to be had by doing epistemology. That is, as by examining our capacities for knowledge and then trying to see if they're adequate for knowing things themselves. So, he comes up with what always strikes me as a stunningly simple solution. Science appears. We could, this is the middle of paragraph 76, this is the turning point, everything about this is about the whole history of philosophy in a few sentences. We could, with better justification, simply spare ourselves the trouble of paying any attention to such ideas and locution, the absolute, cognition, objective, subjective, adventitious ideas, all that kind of junk. For they are intended to ward off science. As the Meno problem, they want science before science. They want to know before they know. They want to learn to swim by sitting on the chaise lounge. Right? That's the thought that Hegel's kind of running here. They want to ward off science itself and constitute merely an empty appearance of knowing, which vanishes immediately as soon as science comes on the scene. But science, just because it comes on the scene, makes an entrance, is itself an appearance. In coming on the scene, it is not yet science in its developed and unfolded truth, etc. Okay, so this is... Think about philosophy always seems to buy the Platonic divided line. Right? Appearances down here. Right? The ideas up here. And a line between them. Philosophy is to get beyond the appearances to the ideas. But what if philosophy, science, itself begins in appearances? What if, rather than opinion or appearances being the antithesis to philosophy, doxa, as opposed to knowledge, what if doxa and appearances are the home soil of knowledge? Well, how can they be the home soil of knowledge? Because, he says, science must appear. Well, how does science appear? It appears by making a claim. Well, how does that help us? Well, because when science, any science, that is, any piece of knowledge appears, it has to distinguish itself from illusion. Right? So the assumption here is that all appearances are illusions, and that just is false. Rather, and this is a little Hegelian bit of logic, he says, essence must appear. Essence must appear. Knowledge, or anything that is, must appear. If it don't appear, we ain't going to know about it. We ain't going to be in touch with it. It ain't going to be matter in our lives. Whatever it is, it must appear. And therefore, the appearance-knowledge distinction is something that's internal to the world of appearances, not outside it. appearance, knowledge distinction, belongs to the world of appearances and is not an object outside. Science, therefore, Hegel says, is the very activity of distinguishing appearance from reality, and it allows us, as it progresses, to confidently distinguish between the two. So we can prepare for science, as it were, make sure that science will do the job of getting only reality and not appearances. Rather, the very effort of science itself is that effort of making those distinctions. So our very conviction that there is an appearance-reality distinction to be drawn actually depends upon having seen science, knowledge, do this. Which is to say, and this is going to be the leitmotif of the entire introduction, science comes on the scene. It is in the business or the activity of distinguishing appearance from reality, and it continues to do so. In other words, rather than a criterion of knowledge or knowledge as product, Hegel puts in its place process. Or to put it another way, every theory of knowledge skips the most important thing about knowledge. The most important thing about knowledge. Think about it. What's the definition of knowledge? Just to try, justify true belief. Okay, and then if you've ever taken a class with Rod Chisholm, you'll know that that gets, 17 clauses to make sure it's okay. Okay. What it forgets is people learn. That learning is a process, that it's a process that occurs over time, and that's filled with misadventures. Indeed, full of mistakes. And furthermore, in ways that become the basis of this book, the mistakes matter to what we know. Unless I had that terrible first marriage, I couldn't have had the good second marriage. I learned something. Maybe not enough, but I learned, right? So learning is not just getting rid of bad stuff or making sure you don't get bad stuff in there, but learning is a process in which you learn from your mistakes, and the mistakes are part of the process. So Hegel is going to make process dominate over product, and he is going to replace knowledge by learning, or what he's going to call education or building. And that everything that's going to be important is going to be over time through a process in which the appearances or the false moments play a role. And not just any old role, but a constitutive role.
How is that really different from Plato? I mean, the idea of anamnesis, knowledge is remembering, and the whole
what could be worse than that?
Well, the whole idea of the educators, the midwife.
You bring it out. It's already there. It's pristine. It's in itself. None of that. mistake on. None of that. You really make real mistakes, you really don't know, and you really do learn. I'm not saying no other philosopher had any other notion of process, but what no other philosophers really took seriously, mostly they didn't like process. I already indicated that definitions of knowledge tend to want the product and cut it off from the learning. Truth should be timeless. No. Hegel said, how can it be timeless? It's a product of a history. Truth can't be timeless. It's a purely temporal thing. But more. Plato, like other philosophers, despise the errors. They despise the mistakes. They want to get them purely distinguished. What we will have at the end of the phenomenology is 599 pages of error and one page of saying, ah, I made all those mistakes. Huh. I see that now. And then those mistakes turn out to be the one-sidedness and so on, all the complexity. But the errors are everything. They're not like things you just, they're everything. They're going to be everything. Otherwise, you can't take history seriously. It's as if you could imagine we could know what the word liberty means or what the word freedom means, but that has nothing to do with slavery. Deontology thinks they can define liberty without the history of acts of rebellion and emancipation. Hegel is denying that. The content of ideas is going to depend on their history. He's going to say in 17 minutes that we literally are that history. Said it. We are nothing but that history in a kind of congealed way. All that history is there in our gestures, in our movements, and that this process is going to be a process of unpacking that history. But that history is a history of errors, not a history of the ideas, not a history of remembering what we saw pristinely before we born and the shock of birth made us forget. What we got to remember is that we've been, you know, Greeks in a slave-owning state and Romans in an atavistic state and we lived in, you know, the feudal period, etc., etc. All that belongs to us. It's in us. So my suggestion is philosophy, and this goes along with the other thought, of course, which I won't go through here, but one of my hobby horses, is philosophy hates children. Children just don't appear. And that's because they're an embarrassment. And they're an embarrassment because they don't know anything, they're out of control. And that would be okay, except children are always out of control, they always don't know anything. Right? So they're always in the state of nature, right? And we want to make sure we're not them. So a philosophy is always about how we can be, and a good deal of feminist philosophy has protested against Rawls, right? On this matter, that no one's ever dependent, no one ever gets ill, no one ever gets old, no one ever gets dependent. I mean, but all these things are the things that philosophy, it wants a kind of purity. And the question, and it's a hard question, I don't mean this to be an easy question, how can we do philosophy without purity? I take it purity is one of the last pre-modern ideas that for the most part has no role in the modern world. Right? Except in philosophy. Philosophy is always a work of hygiene and purification. Call it authenticity. So Hegel wants a philosophy of the impure, of the mistakes, of the errors, of the fantasies, of the delusions, of the egoisms, and wants to tie whatever's worth knowing to those moments. Hence, again, the very structure of this introduction depends upon that notion of the fear of error. Now, that's not going to go away. We have to, to understand that epistemology is dependent on anxiety and fear is not something that can disappear from our understanding, because we have to acknowledge that in ourselves. Hence my mention of jealousy. That these are deep structures and therefore temptations, right? And getting past and seeing how we reify our own temptations or our own ways of avoiding temptation is what the history of philosophy has been. Philosophy has always been a search for some kind of self-assurance. But the self-assurance has always wanted to negate those things that it wanted to escape from. There's no escape. So, the intelligibility of the product for Hegel is going to depend on the process. And science is going to be non-detachable from learning. I just think that this is crucial. The test case I always imagine is if there was this pill. You take this pill. And you have the sensation of just having finished reading on a Quran. You didn't read it, but you have the sensation that you just closed the book. Surely that would miss something. Well, the same in philosophy. You don't want to get rid of the whole process, right, by which you get to the conclusion. Paragraph 77. So, knowledge, that's a long, sweaty way of saying knowledge makes an appearance. Science must appear. So, now what Hegel's going to have to do is figure out a way of figuring out how to write philosophy in a way that can take that thought on board, which is not obvious. Right? I mean, it's a great idea. one way of doing it, the one he doesn't follow here, you may think, is simply to write the entire history of philosophy. Right? And make, try to, and of course he does eventually do that. Right? But here he's going to try something else. So, paragraph 77, natural consciousness. Now, because it has only phenomenal knowledge for its object, this exposition seems not to be science, free and self-moving in its own peculiar shape. Yet from this standpoint, it can be regarded as the path of natural consciousness, which presses forward to true knowledge, or as the way of the soul which journeys through the series of its own configurations, as though they were stations appointed for it by its own nature, so that it may purify itself for the life of the spirit and achieve finally through completed experience of itself the awareness of what it is really in itself. That's natural consciousness. Great debates about natural consciousness. And for some reason, lots of people seem to think it's Greek consciousness. And I can never find anything natural about Greek consciousness. And it's not the way the book begins, and it's hard to read the notion of natural consciousness as structural or methodological if you begin with the notion of Greek consciousness. So I interpret natural consciousness, not the consciousness of the man on the street, so this isn't more doing common sense, nor is it exactly Husserl's notion of the natural attitude. It's not that either. Natural consciousness is any form of consciousness that spontaneously and immediately takes itself to be in possession of the truth. Consciousness is any form of consciousness that unreflectively takes itself to be in possession of the truth. The claims, therefore, of natural consciousness can be endlessly complicated. Philosophy takes itself to be a series of theories about the nature of knowledge or the nature of the world, and therefore you simply begin with a theory that's just there. So, again, you know, Rogers and you just begin with, Plato and Theaetetus, knowledge is just by true belief. It's just there. Now, of course, you need to work on it, blah, 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 but the thought is, it's spontaneously there. You don't have to worry about where it came from, how it got there. So the notion of natural consciousness is the unanxious, unworried assumption that you know that knowledge is just a true belief, or that knowledge is whatever Newton says, or that morality is what's there in the moral law. What's naturalness the opposite of, then? Naturalness is philosophy, and indeed ordinary consciousnesses, unawareness of its social and historical presuppositions. So it makes it natural is its presumption of being ahistorical and asocial, and therefore of conditioned in all those ways. So the various manifestations of science appear and press beyond themselves. Science is going to be now the process by which natural consciousness works through the various attempts to reassure itself that it is indeed in possession of the truth it claims to be in possession of, fails in those claims, goes on to another station of the cross. Station of the cross. Maybe we'll have to come back to that phrase, right? Goes on to another station of the cross and tries again. So it's going to be that serious. So natural consciousness will show itself, Hegel says, to be only the notion of knowledge, or in other words, not to be real knowledge. That is, it will be a concept of knowledge. That natural consciousness will have a concept of knowledge. And by the way, knowledge here can be a concept of knowledge, but it can also be a concept of God. It can be a concept of morality. It can be a concept of politics. It can be whatever. And I want to be clear here. So knowledge, although this is going to start by talking about knowledge and epistemology, knowledge here can be any categorical determination that's capable of providing the anchor for a fundamental mode of comportment toward the world. I'm going to say that again. I just made it up. Right? So, natural consciousness is going to be not just about knowledge, but any categorical determination that is sufficient to determine a fundamental orientation toward the world. That is, in each case, a form of natural consciousness will be a way of how people think they are fundamentally connected to the world in general. So one of the ways people might imagine they're fundamentally connected to the world in general is by knowing it, by representing it. That's one kind of way of connecting to the world. But if you're another kind of person, you may think your fundamental connection to the world is believing in God. Or you may think believing in the Pope. Or you may think that the fundamental connection is by doing mathematical physics, that that's the only true activity. Or you may think it's by fighting a revolution, following the moral law. All of these can be thought of, and they really can be thought of, as fundamental modes of accessing the world in general. That is, how people take a stand upon themselves in relationship to the world. So everyone will come back to the double structure of every one of consciousness. But each one is going to be a mode of fundamental comportment. So natural consciousness now, up to paragraph 78. We're flying along here. Is going this slow helpful? I know you all was talking to people outside and said, oh yeah, the introduction was pretty easy. And I thought, oh, now you tell me. I thought it was pretty tricky. It's readable. This is the text that are not readable. It's readable, but it's not easy. It's not easy to unpack what's going on here, and see how it amounts to something like a way of going on. Natural consciousness. Let's see if we can do this paragraph. Natural consciousness will show itself to be only the notion of knowledge, or in other words, not to be real knowledge, but since it directly takes itself to be real knowledge, this path has a negative significance for it, and what is in fact the realization of the notion counts for it rather as the loss of its own self, for it does lose its truth on this path. The road can therefore be regarded as the pathway of doubt, or more precisely, as the way of despair, for what happens on it is not what is ordinarily understood when the word doubt is used, shilly-shallying about this or that presumed truth, followed by a return to the truth again, after the doubt has been appropriately dispelled, so that at the end of the process the matter is taken to be what it was in the first place. On the contrary, modern epistemology, that is. We do all that work. We do all that work so we can say the book is on the table. Just seems... huh? Anyway, on the contrary, the path is the consciousness insight into the untruth of phenomenal knowledge, for which the supreme reality is what is in truth only the unrealized notion. Therefore, this thoroughgoing skepticism is also not the skepticism with which an earnest zeal for truth and science fancies is prepared and equipped itself in their service. The resolve in science not to give itself over to the thoughts of others by mere authority, but to examine everything for oneself upon only one's conviction, or better still, to produce everything oneself and accept only one's own deed as the truth. Essential here is the word takes. You knew that. It takes. It doesn't matter whether it is true or not. What matters is it takes itself to be true. Now, in saying it takes itself to be true is to say that it doesn't have a mere opinion about what knowledge is. It has an overwhelming conviction. So this is already a story of an erotic binding of oneself. So natural consciousness appears as erotically bound states of conviction. A desire for the truth and a wanting of the truth and a conviction that one is in possession of that truth. And that's what's important, because it is in light of that, that is only if you take yourself really to be in possession of this, will you act accordingly. That is, you act in ways that try to register that truth. And in trying to register that truth and acting in that way, you're going to lose it. You're going to fight the revolution and find yourself in a bloody terror. So that the only way that Hegel says, nothing great appears without passion. Right? So this is so when I talked about categorical commitments, let's call them categorical passions. So this is a study of those categorical passions through which people have tried to orient themselves in the world. And because they were passions, then when they collapse, you lose everything. That's why this is not about doubt, but about despair. You have put your all in the thought of the French Revolution. You've put your all in the thought of the moral law. You've put your all in the thought of sense certainty. And in the very attempt to assure yourself of its truth, in the very attempt to make it true, in the very attempt to elaborate and make a world that corresponds to it, it will go under. It does go under. It's the history of these going unders. And hence, this is not about mere epistemology, hence, you know, the easy crack at Hume and Descartes. This is much more the way of despair, because these are about modes of world constitution and world laws. And that when your categorical orientation in the world collapses, you don't sit back and say, phew, got rid of another bad idea. Because life is not about getting rid of bad ideas, it's finding a way of living. And when the mode that constitutes your connection to the world collapses, then everything collapses. So this really is the way of despair. Hence the notion of stations on the cross. You are being, these are ways in which Western humanity has tested itself, tried out its various ways of what it is that constitutes our ways of being in the world, and found that over and over again, these great modes of articulating our being in the world collapse. The series of configurations which consciousness goes through along this road is a reality of the detailed history of the education of consciousness itself from the standpoint of science. Let us look for a moment, we'll stop here, at paragraphs 28 and 29 in the preface. They are a discussion of education. So there are little bits of the preface we might read and understand. And then I'll pick up from there next time. Over the week, you can kind of take a good look at these paragraphs. These are a fuller exposition of that one sentence that we just read. He says the single individual, this is third sentence, paragraph 28, the single individual is incomplete spirit, a concrete shape in whose whole existence one determinateness predominates, the others being present in blurred outlines. You didn't know that about yourself. You are, each of us is, an indeterminate moment of spirit in which one moment predominates. He's talking now to his audience, and all the rest occur merely in blurred outline. Now, he goes on to say, in a spirit that is more advanced than another, the lower concrete existence has been reduced to an inconspicuous moment. What used to be the important thing is now but a trace. Its pattern is shrouded to become a mere shadowy outline. The individual whose substance is the more advanced spirit runs through this pass just as one who takes up a higher science goes through the preparatory studies, etc., etc. So, each of us, suggesting earlier, has embedded in us already, just by having a moment of spirit that predominates and being in the place in history where we are nothing but a congealing or sedimentation or concretion of that history of which the earlier moments exist as, ooh, let's call them our cultural unconscious. They're there in their concentrated state. Therefore, in unpacking the history, we're not unpacking, and this is why this is going to be a difficult work of reading, we're not unpacking someone else's history. We're not reading an external history, like reading the history of the Roman Empire. We're reading the history of ourselves. We're reading our own coming to be. And of course, the difficulty is that we have to learn to recognize ourselves, the blurred, traced, buried, sedimented moments, that are all these earlier moments. So as we read, Hegel's not going to want us to be outsiders in the text. He's going to want us to identify with, this is why people have often thought this is a Bildungsroman of a certain kind, to identify with the various forms of consciousness. They should not be reading about some bizarre figures, but they should be readings of what are subtly scary alter egos. There, but for the grace of history, there I. So, he says, we shall recognize the history of the cultural development of the world traced, as it were, in silhouette. This past existence is already acquired property of the universal spirit, which constitutes the substance of the individual, and hence appears externally to him as his inorganic nature. That is, we tend to read this stuff in textbook, and it appears not as our living stuff, but as the way inorganic nature appears, namely as an externality. The goal is to make substance, inorganic nature, subject. That is, to take this stuff and make it not an external fact, but come to recognize it as the coming to be of our own self-consciousness. So, Hegel puts this in a kind of ironic way, middle paragraph 29. He says, since substance of the individual, the world spirit itself had the patience to pass through these shapes over the long passage of time and to take upon itself the enormous labor of world history, in which it embodied in each shape as much of its entire content as that shape was capable of holding, and since it could never have attained consciousness of itself by any lesser effort, the individual certainly cannot, by the nature of the case, comprehend his own substance more easily. That's a message. It's going to be a long, hard text. If history was hard, and you are that history, then somehow you have got to go through the labor of unearthing that stuff as your moment and work through it. But this, as I said, is just like what a therapeutic process is. You can't just, as Freud, I'll kind of stop with the Freud analogy and we'll pick up there next week. Freud said, look, patients walked into the office. I could tell the patient, you know, look, you wanted to sleep with your mother and kill your father. And nowadays, of course, any patient who walks into a therapist's office probably says to the therapist, you know, that knowledge is useless, Freud says. That's nothing. It's nothing because you haven't worked through it. That is, you don't have any of the affects of necessary of what it is to acknowledge ambivalence, to acknowledge that you can both love someone and have murderous feelings toward them, and that if you don't, something's wrong with you, and that you can desperately, more than anything in the world, want to sleep with your mother or father, and it's the one thing you must never do, etc., etc. And to find all that and to work through it and show how you've acted out that by the failure of not acknowledging it your whole life, that's the sort of investment as I read it, that Hegel's asking for when he says it's not going to be any easier for us. We have to, yeah.
Can I ask a question?
Sure.
Tell me if I, because I want to just twist a little bit of what you said and tell me if it sounds okay to you. Mm-hmm. That it's not going to be easy, that what becoming an individual is has to do with his working through a world history. But in both the middle of paragraph 28 and the middle of paragraph 29, he adds these yets. And the yets, after the passage you just said, you just read, say, yet at the same time he has less trouble, which I want to suggest is actually another kind of trouble.
Yep.
Since all this has been implicitly accomplished. And then one of the, and then on the other page, you know, that the kid already has reduced to the level of facts, exercises, and games for children,
right,
what occupied the minds of mature men for generations before.
Right.
So that on the one hand, there's all this working through.
Yep.
And that's part of the trouble. But on the other hand, part of the trouble is that we've already got it all in this, but, you know, already from the get-go.
Absolutely.
And that there was less, the fact that there was less trouble with having, in bearing this, is part of the real trouble.
Absolutely. Part of the trouble, of course, is exactly that, of course, we take for granted freedom, individuality, equality, natural science, blah, blah, all these things that we're accomplishing this. And to find them troubling again in the right way, to see what kind of achievement they are and how they are worked out, turns out to be different. Okay, let's stop there. You can pick up from me or Rossio your mini commentaries. Other people can hand in mini commentaries. And if you want to have a chat, since the mail will get crossed, I'll talk to anyone who wants to have a word outside in the front, since they want to close the building in 10 minutes. Yeah.